G'day expats, welcome to another episode of Expat Chat. Today we're doing part two of talking with a US tax specialist. I'm joined today with Jason Stock, the Managing Director of Uptrend Advisory. G'day Jason, how are you going?
G'day. Hey James, doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me again. I'm excited to continue our conversation. I know that we ran over time last time, but I guess it just means that we've got a lot to talk about.
That's right, mate. Today, I think we covered a fair bit in our last episode, and there was a lot that we didn't get to really dive into. I think today we want to focus on a lot of things which Australians receive when they are in the US, working for a lot of those different, I suppose, tech companies, but not just tech companies. So today we're going to dive into a little bit about, you know, those RSUs and options, and I guess how they're treated from a US tax point of view. We're going to touch on, you know, what do you do if you've messed up your US tax returns or you haven't lodged or something like that. I feel like that's a pretty common one, to be honest. I know I commonly get a lot of inquiries about that, and I'm not a US tax accountant, so you're usually my go-to guy on what to do there. A few other things, home ownership, green cards, exit tax. I think that's more specific on the HARD Act, just because we commonly get that one. And I lastly just want to wind it up on inheritances. A lot of, I suppose, right now, especially in Australia, we're going through this period where it's the largest sort of shift in intergenerational wealth, especially from your sort of baby boomers onto the next generation. And we have a lot of clients and a lot of, inquiries that do reach out to us about inheritances and what it means. Normally, that expat that's receiving the inheritance, you know, they're either maybe just a green card holder, potentially a dual citizen, US and Australia, or they're just on an E3 or an L1 or that one of those kind of visas. So I just want to dive into that towards the end of today's podcast. But I suppose before we move into anything further, we should do a little disclaimer. So a little disclaimer, all listeners today is just treated for your entertainment purposes only. If you do need advice, please feel free to reach out to either myself or Jason for specific personal advice. Today should just be treated as entertainment purposes only. I think that'll do it in terms of a bit of a disclaimer, always getting better at those. But why don't we kick into it, Jason? So, I mean, the first sort of query and topic I'm going to ask you about is US tax returns and, you know, more broadly, you know, what do we do if we've messed up a US tax return, forgot to file something, or, you know, have missed a few years? You know, generally speaking, you know, what's the process into sort of getting back in the good books with the IRS? And you might have more specific examples.
Yeah. So that's a great one. The hardest thing is to know when you've made a mistake, because often as an expat, you know, you'd be paying a professional to do it for you, mm-hmm. and just hoping they know what they're doing. But sometimes there are firms that will take on the work without understanding, you know, all of the international aspects that go with it.
And yes.
So it's often a client only is made aware of this when eventually they come to an international specialist like myself, where we see these things every day, and it's very quick for us to point out what the gaps are. Same thing with filers who use something like TurboTax. You don't know what you don't know until someone points it out. Right. And then I guess once you do know, you know, it can be a bit overwhelming, but thankfully, you know, there are amnesty programs that the IRS has that you can get back into compliance, so long as you know, the mistakes weren't willful, as in, you know, tax avoidance and all of those kinds of things. So assuming it was, you know, non-willful, then there are lots of programs you can go through that will get you back in good standing with the IRS and will help you avoid all of the penalties and fines that would normally be associated with just leaving it as is. So I guess there is a way out, and they've specifically designed all these things. So it's not all gloom and doom.
Yep.
You do have a way back to compliance.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a good, I suppose, item that you mentioned before there about how I know, which is very common with clients and new inquiries that receive, that their employer has some sort of agreement with one of the big four accounting firms. And I'm obviously not naming and shaming, but we know who they are. And it's very common that things are missed or incorrectly interpreted, and they are receiving that benefit either on the first US tax year, or they're lucky enough to receive the benefit whilst they're in the US, where one of the big four is taking care of them for the, you know, going forward. And eventually, when they might leave that employer and pursue other job prospects or career interests in the US, that they no longer have that entitlement. And that's actually when they're moving to now either using TurboTax or engaging someone like yourself or another accountant, where, you know, it's a case where things are picked up and go, you know, crap, okay, they've actually missed an FBAR, or they haven't actually been declaring this asset, which is pretty important that they should have, or this investment, or they've been misinterpreted what this is. This should be cleaned up, because you're now going down the path of, you know, a green card, and, you know, we need to now lean on, obviously, maybe one of those amnesty programs that you mentioned. So it is very common when expats head into the US, yep, they'll might have the benefit of the big four accounting firms look after them, but from what we've seen, it's a very common that you are sort of given an account manager, you're an account number, you give them what you've got, and essentially they'll go and file it. And it's very common that things get missed or misinterpreted. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, because I've seen things go wrong very quickly. So sometimes I think, you know, if you are getting this benefit, you should really query with, you know, the account that's looking after you. Oh yeah, do you need to know this? Do you need to know what my super fund is? Do you need to know the direct shares that I'm holding and what they are, where they're domiciled? Do you need to know that I have an investment property that I'm renting out? Do you need to know about this cash account that I'm hiding from my wife that has a few hundred thousand dollars in it that you shouldn't know about? Things like that, to give a bit of an example. Just because when things are missed, yep, that's when things can go pear-shaped. But I guess it's important to understand that, yeah, there are roadmaps and ways that you can get back to being compliant. I mean, Jason, with your sort of types of clients, expats, I mean, is it pretty common that, you know, when you get new inquiries, that you have a client come to you where they might have a few US tax returns outstanding and they're not knowing what to do? I mean, how common is that occurrence?
Yeah, I've had quite a number of clients this year, especially where they've come to me and they've said they haven't filed for a number of years, and it's quite a daunting task, and they're worried about, you know, if I file now and I'm filing so late, am I going to get hit hard and things like that. And so it's almost making them non-compliant out of fear, whereas, you know, again, depending on the intention and things like that, there are ways you can backfile those returns and get back into compliance and good standing. And then similarly, there are other clients who, you know, who have come to me who have used other preparers in the past, and I have seen that there were some gaps, you know, some from the big four as well. And it's just a matter of being proactive about remediating these things. You know, before other things get discovered.
Absolutely. Squashing it as soon as you become aware of maybe a bit of a gap, and rather than sticking your head in the sand, which can be quite common for expats, and just assuming it'll all be good. But yeah, again, you know, trying to really drill home that there are ways to clean things up. You're not left to sort of clean up. Or very common, some clients that might bounce back to Australia, they'll just put it in that sort of too hard basket and actually never sort of clean up their taxes ever. And probably under the assumption that they might not never return to the US. And, you know, now that COVID sort of washed through, they might get another great opportunity in the US and go, shit, I'm going back to the US. I need to clean up the tax returns now because I'm going to be on the same social security number, those sort of things. So I reckon that's probably going to be a theme that we might see play out in the next 2-3 years, because I'll admit a lot of Aussies did bounce back to Australia when they had the opportunity to. You know, they were either working from home in Australia for their US companies on US hours. Couldn't imagine doing that. That would throw out your rhythm. But it was a common theme. And I think, yeah, now that they've sort of been here in Australia, they've probably forgotten, oh, yeah, I still have US tax obligations because I might be heading back there. So there are ways to compliance. It's just about, you know, obviously engaging the right person.
Yeah, and another example that I saw this year as well with COVID was, you know, Aussies had come to the US, they'd activated their green card, and then because of COVID, they went back to Australia. And because they've been in Australia, you know, there have been people that have been under the impression that they didn't have to file anything in America because they haven't been there. So it's it's those types of situations where you don't know what you don't know until you know. So.
Yeah, exactly right. Until finally they receive a letter or something, or an accountant tells them, hang on, you're meant to file. You meant to file back in March or May. We're well past the due date now. Well, thanks for mercy. That's been a really a good topic to talk about. I want to now drive this into, as I said, a very common benefit that a lot of expats receive when they're in the US. And I'm talking now about your RSUs, so restricted stock units, options, and there are several different types of options, ISOs and NSOs. So we'll dive into that. But RSUs, I mean, RSUs are probably one of the easier ones to sort of pick apart. Restricted stock units. So Jason, give us a bit of an, just, you know, what is an RSU, you know, and how are they commonly treated through sort of an employment package that you have, say, with Apple or Facebook or Amazon?
Yeah. So all of those, you know, tech companies, Uber as well, they give their employees restricted stock units, which essentially are a bonus component to their entire package, you know, wages, 401k match, you know, time off. RSUs are just another component. Now, instead of getting like a $40,000 cash bonus at the end of the year, they would have stock that vests over cliffs, typically 3 or 4 years, and that is what's issued to them as a bonus. So instead of cash, you're given Uber shares, and so you then hold those shares and can sell them in the future, triggering capital gains and things like that. But when they're issued to you after they vest, it would be considered ordinary income as if they had paid you the equivalent in cash.
Yep.
So what this would mean is that come tax time in the year that it's issued, let's say you're on a salary of 200,000, but you receive 40,000 worth of RSUs, you're actually going to be taxed as if you earned 240,000 in that calendar year.
Yep.
And what a lot of these companies do is, you know, when you're an employee, you have payroll withhold wages from each pay cycle, so that come tax time, there's been enough withheld so that you can file your tax and not have a huge amount owed.
Mm-hmm.
But with RSUs, that component, that gets treated very differently.
Yeah.
And that's because, let's say you and I were employees of Uber, James.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm on 200, you're on 400, because, you know, you're much better than me. And in terms in terms of stock, I'm only going to be receiving 50,000 this year, whereas you're going to be receiving 100,000. So you can already see that we're kind of very far apart in terms of our income levels. Now, you know, Uber payroll would be withholding for your 400K component easily. Fine. Mm-hmm. They know how you're going to land in the tax bracket. Same with my 200. But it's too complicated for them to then add the layer of the RSUs by how much is being issued with your wages and the fact that there's so many employees at Uber. It goes into the too hard basket for payroll. So as a result of that, they will take a benchmark approach as to how much they withhold with RSUs from every employee, no matter their wage or salary or other income stream levels.
So they don't apply what your set marginal rate is. It sounds like they, like you said, they pick one of three rates and that's it.
Yeah, because it would be too difficult for them to manually work out everyone's individual withholding based on how much RSUs they're getting that year, what their wages is going to be. It's just, it's put in a too hard basket. And they'd rather take something than nothing. So they typically then would just take a flat rate across the board for everyone. And then some companies do a good job of communicating to their employees that, okay, we're withholding this much from your RSUs. You're responsible for whatever excess there is. And what I mean by that is, going back to the example, let's say I'm on 200. Let's just say I'm in the 25% tax bracket. You're on the 400K salary. You're in the 30% tax bracket, to keep it simple. Now, the benchmark that they would withhold RSUs can either be 22% or 37%. They always give the employees one of two options. Now, assuming it's 22% withholding for both of us, that means I know I will have a 3% shortfall because my tax bracket is 25. Whereas you're going to have an 8% shortfall from your 30% tax bracket, which means come tax time, you're going to have to pay that shortfall in one go.
Do they, when the RSUs, I mean, when they're withholding this amount, is it a case where they withhold it by selling down a portion of the RSUs that are given to you? That's where the tax is coming from. So is that where they're taking the actual tax from, or are they paying it out, you know, separately? So they're giving us, you know, whatever it might be, 50,000 or 100,000 worth of RSUs. Is it a case that they have to sell down a portion of those RSUs to cover the that flat tax rate or whatever it might be?
Yes. So most of these companies engage in what they call a sell to cover, which is literally the purpose of what you just described, to sell enough to cover the tax associated with the whole lump sum being issued.
Yeah, okay. Oh, gosh. So, I didn't realize, I mean, it's a case where in some situations, there actually can be a bit of a shortfall, to be honest, based on those different, I suppose, gaps, which means, yeah, a solid tax payable coming up at the end of the year. I know some clients and some consults I've had with inquiries where they are on a really, really good wicket and they receive RSUs. But again, if they're only withholding at that, say, 25% rate, but their average tax rate is 37%, there's a huge gap there. They're going to have to withhold, you know, 50, 80, 100 grand just in savings just for when that tax bill rolls around, which, again, might not roll around for 12 months. And you want to make plans for that money as well.
And sometimes, you know, yeah, sorry.
I was going to ask, with that, is there any way that you know, that US taxpayer, that employee, can they go to an accountant and go, after they've received the RSUs and go, okay, I've received this, is there any way I can just pay this tax now so I don't, I can make a bit of a plan for my money over the next 12 months? Can they pay tax early based on those RSUs vesting?
Yeah, so that was something, that was another piece that goes with this, is that when you're receiving such a large amount of RSUs outside of your wages, the IRS and potentially state may want you to actually make quarterly estimated tax payments so that they're getting their money throughout the year in installments, as opposed to waiting till the end of the year. Because if you wait till the end of the year to pay the IRS 80K, they might hit you with an under withholding penalty because you've technically borrowed money from them the whole year and only waited to pay them at the end. So, you know, you might have to look at making these payments.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose the equivalent back in Australia, you know, if you're running a small business or you're self-employed and you have to do your quarterly BASs or your quarterly, say, POIG tax installments, most accounts will put people on POIG installments if they've got another source of income outside their wage income. So, you know, if they've got, say, rental properties which are positively geared and it's giving them an extra 20 or 30,000 per year, then the accountant might say, okay, well, we need to make sure you're putting away maybe an additional probably $2,000 every quarter. And then, you know, you've received that quarterly statement in your mail or through your MyGov ATO online service, and then you go and pay it. right now, I know the ATO is really good. They send you messages and text messages now saying, hey, you've got that quarterly installment coming up. It's due in 3 weeks' time. Just a reminder, you know, get it lodged, those sort of things. So that works similar to the way, I suppose, the ATO would work, but we don't really have RSUs. We've got other, I suppose, share purchase plans and benefits. I want to now segue over to options, because options, I feel like, get very confusing for a lot of expats which are in the US. And there's plenty of really good articles out there about, you know, the difference between your ISOs and your NSOs and the difference in tax treatment. But, you know, we'll talk about ISOs first. You know, what does ISO stand for in terms of the option?
Yeah, that would be an incentive stock option. So you are incentivized to buy it because of the bargain element that you're getting it for. You're instead of buying a stock directly on the market, you have the ability to buy your own company stock at a slight discount. So that's why it's an incentive. But it's a very unique type of option because it triggers a unique type of tax calculation come tax time. And a lot of people aren't familiar with this, but it's called alternative minimum tax, or AMT. And essentially what AMT is it's just a different way of them calculating your tax come tax time. So typically, you know, you would have your normal tax where you have your income, all of it, your income components, the wages, dividends, interest, capital gains, all of that rolling into one total amount. And then you'll have your standard deduction or itemization, whichever one of the two you do, which would then give you your net taxable amount, which then goes into that marginal tax table. And then you have your calculation, and then it spits out a refund or bill at the end. Whereas AMT is something that runs in parallel to that, where certain things are added to that total income table and then taxed at AMT rates, which is 26 or 28%, depending on how much you're earning. So it's not a marginal tax table like your normal tax calculation. So think of it as like a background parallel calculation. And so ultimately what happens is whichever of the two results in you paying more tax, the IRS will want you to use, because why wouldn't they? And where ISOs come into this is because the spread, which is, you know, the fair market value when you exercise your ISO versus your strike price, what you're paying for it, that spread, the difference between the two, that gain is what would be one of those things that's added to that AMT calculation bucket. And there are AMT exemptions and things like that, and I don't want to get more complicated than it needs to be, but essentially, because that ISO gets thrown into that alternative calculation in the background, that can contribute to you ultimately needing to pay the AMT methodology instead of normal tax, because it results in you having a higher taxable amount through that calculation style.
Yeah. I mean, the real benefit of the ISOs is just the fact that, you know, the fair market value, I mean, pretty good example, actually. I know, actually, no, I probably can't talk about that because I don't know if that's market. I was about to say something that I really shouldn't have, to be honest. I'll tell Jason in the background, but I can't put that out in the public as a liquidity event, everyone, for a very well-known company that is not public. That's all I can say. But the benefit of what has happened with a lot of employees is that they've had options. There's been a liquidity event. It's not a public company, but there's been investors into the company, and it's been an option for a lot of employees to actually action all these ISOs that they've received. And it's been a really good benefit because it means they're finally getting rewarded for all their hard work over the last 5-10 years. But the benefit for them is just the fact that the fair market value of the share is, you know, whatever it might be, say $500. And, you know, their sort of strike price is only $100. So look at that gap. You know, they're making such a good wicket there based on that liquidity event. But again, yep, that's obviously going to trigger that AMT. And as you said, there's different exemptions that go into that. But it sounds like the AMT is just driven that you are paying some sort of minimum tax regardless, because something is obviously going to be due to the IRS there, you know, regardless of the end of the calendar year. So as long as you're paying something, and then it sounds like it gets cleaned up when you actually lodge your tax return, whether you owe any tax as well.
Correct, yeah. So it all comes out in the wash come tax time. You'll owe what you owe when you've exercised it. And then what's important is that once you've exercised that fair market value, that becomes your new cost basis in that stock, because you now hold it at that time. So that would be your 500 cost basis. And if that company is, you know, worth $1,000 per share in a year's time, if you sold it in a year's time, it would be that 1,000 minus your $500 step up. You wouldn't be using that $100 base anymore because you already paid that step up when you exercised your ISOs.
Yeah. And I mean, depending on where expats are residing, they might exercise their options and sell down straight away. And it's very likely that there probably isn't a short-term gain, or maybe a very small one, depending on how many days or weeks that they've held it. And then obviously the long-term gain or long-term tax is, yeah, holding it for a minimum of 12 months. But I guess speaking of RSUs and ISOs, and we'll go into NSOs as well soon, but I mean, very common that a lot of my clients, as well as expats in general, when they're in the US, you know, they get these RSUs and options dumped on them, and there is those vesting cliffs. And over time, it means that if they're working for the right employer, their wealth as a whole can be skewed towards one share or one holding. It happens. It's very common in the US. And it's important to make sure, and just from a conservative point of view, that you are diversifying. And it's very common. It's something that we help a lot of our clients with, where over the time that they're receiving these vested shares, they'll either still hold a portion because they're still obviously wedded to the company and enjoy the company, but they will diversify. You know, they'll wind down their shares and redeploy it across their different, I guess, asset buckets, you know, whether it's paying down some debt, investing in some property, or investing in a more diversified portfolio, you know, accounting for the currencies as well. So it is important that you're not leaving the US and all your wealth, or 95% of your wealth, is in one share, because it means you're now riding the emotions of that share or that holding every day, which, you know, it doesn't take much. Look at what happened to Tesla recently. God, someone take away his login to Twitter. Far out. There's a controversy around that, actually, with Elon Musk's brother selling some shares before he put up that poll. But that being said, it is important to diversify when you are receiving these benefits, not exposing yourself or overexposing yourself to just one holding. But I guess with options, there's only going to be, if you're receiving options in a startup, you know, you're not, it's a case where you're kind of waiting for a liquidity event before you can actually exercise them, because there might not be a fair market for them as well. So that's probably the drawback, but eventually that'll come around. NSOs. So what is an NSO, Jason?
Yeah. So, you know, all those points were really good. You know, I'm just an accountant, so I can't really give that type of financial advice, but all very good points that all lead you down the roadmap of success, especially when you're planning for retirement. So that way, you know, everything's secure and rock solid, as opposed to, as you were saying, you're riding the roller coaster of just one stock and you don't know what it's going to be the next day, especially if Elon's tweeting about it. So in terms of NSOs, so NSOs are non-qualified stock options. It's the final, you know, unique type of stock option that the US companies offer to employees. And this essentially allows you to, just similarly to an ISO, buy a stock at a fixed price. You've got your grant price and the fair market value, and the spread is treated as ordinary income, and there's no AMT. So you deal with it in the year that you're actually buying it, and it's just taxed in that manner. Any time after you've exercised, you have that step up in cost basis because you paid that ordinary income tax. Mm-hmm. And then in the future, if you were to sell it, it's either long-term or short-term gain based on, you know, that stepped up cost basis that you paid for in the year that you exercised your NSOs. So not as common has the ISOs and RSUs, but is still a very good option to buy shares at a discount.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the NSOs are a little bit easier to understand, to be honest, compared to the ISOs. I mean, whatever the difference is between fair market value and that strike price that you've been given, ordinary income, if you continue to hold them, as you said, then CGT will, or capital gains tax will apply at the different rates, depending on how you hold it. I would see the NSOs as actually a lot easier to understand compared to all your AMTs, and then you've got your exemptions, your park elements. But I guess that's, you know, why you get an accountant and have that conversation.
And there's, you know, tax benefits for the company depending on what types of things they issue. So ISOs and RSUs definitely benefit them, whereas the NSOs clearly have less benefit given they're not as commonly issued.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to segue away from, I suppose, employee benefits that they get from their employers. And I now want to touch on home ownership in the US and tax benefits, because we get obviously clients asking us, should we buy a house here, or should we invest back in property back in Australia? And how does that look from a tax point of view? And I guess it's something where buying property in the US, it's not really something I can really provide advice on. I mean, it's not a financial product or anything like that. So it does come down to a personal, position and personal decision based on how long you might reside in the US as well. But I mean, when you look at home ownership in the US and living in that house in the US, what kind of tax benefits do you get as a US taxpayer when you're buying a home and living in it?
Yeah, so the things that would be unique to the US side compared to Australia was that in your annual tax returns, I did talk about it briefly earlier, there's something called the standard deduction or itemizing. It's a methodology that taxpayers can make each year. You're not locked into one, you can switch between the years, but essentially it is a way for you to calculate a deduction against your income. You can only take one of the two, you cannot take both of them. The standard deduction increases every year with inflation. You know, for 2020 it was $12,400. You just get that free offset against your income. There's no substantiation needed or anything. Most people take that, but home ownership gives you the ability to itemize, because on that itemization schedule, which is a prescribed list, one of the things is mortgage interest. So if you've bought a property in the US and, you know, you put your 10% down or 20% down, chances are your mortgage interest is going to be quite high, to the tune of where it would actually exceed that $12,400. There's other things on that list as well, that itemization schedule, such as state tax, real estate tax, property tax, that you can claim as well. And so ultimately, through itemizing, you could probably get much, much higher of a deduction than if you were to just take the standard deduction. So what that means is that you would be enjoying the tax benefit of owning that home by having greater deductions against your taxable income every single year that you own that home and have that mortgage tied to it.
Wow.
So that's it. Just, yeah.
I mean, that's incredible, to be honest. And it's very, very different to the way Australia and our tax system operates with the ATO. I mean, we don't get any benefits from a tax position or tax deduction position for the house that we actually live in. Obviously, we get the benefits from investment properties. With the itemizing versus, say, the standard, is there a point or a ceiling in which you can't claim anymore? So I know a good example. A client's recently bought a property in California. Good for them, to be honest, the way that property market is. And they've got a very large mortgage where I think the mortgage is more than $980,000 US. So they would be able to claim the interest on that, which the interest expense alone per annum is going to be a fair bit, to be honest. So under that assumption, if their mortgage rates are 2%, they are pretty comfortable in claiming, by the sounds of it, you know, all their interest, which might be more than, say, 40, 50, 60,000.
Yeah, so that is correct. The only limitation on that is that the IRS, and this changes, you know, as new legislation comes into play, is that you're able to claim the mortgage interest up to $750,000 worth of a mortgage. So in that example, you've said they've got a mortgage of $900,000. That would mean they could only claim $750,000 worth of the interest on that mortgage. So, you know, you'd have to look at the ratio and prorate that. So if I just do some quick math, it would mean they can claim 83% of that $40,000 mortgage interest via the itemization schedule. So it is capped, but that $40,000 is still much, much higher than that $12,400.
It so is.
Yeah.
I mean,
there'd be no reason not to take it.
It isn't. I mean, I just, like you said, quick math. I just did some quick math then. 2.5%, $750,000. That's $18,750 as a quick interest expense deduction. That's well above the $12,000. So I guess, you know, they have the income to support that kind of mortgage. So, you know, in no way am I encouraging you to go out and get a ridiculous loan to value ratio in the US. That's silly. But that's very interesting. Home ownership is somewhat encouraged in the US because of the benefits of these itemized deductions. That's proof is there right there. Proof is in the pudding. Interest expense, $18,750 on a loan worth $750,000 at 2.5% interest rate. That's incredible.
Yeah. And then, you know, as I was saying, that's not the only thing on the itemization schedule. So you're definitely going to be above that amount when you factor in the other things that are on the schedule too, such as the state tax, the property tax, all of these things that then can get added on top. So that would just be the floor of what you can claim in this situation.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's very different compared to, I suppose, yeah, Australian tax rules. What about when we eventually sell the US home? What happens there from a capital gains tax position? Do we owe tax? What are the rules around that in the US?
Yeah, so the rules are pretty simple, pretty black and white, in that it is a 2-year out of 5-year rule. And what I mean by that is if you've lived in the property as your primary residence for 2 years out of the most recent 5-year window, you get capital gains exemptions. Now, these exemptions are tied to your filing status. So if you're filing single in America, your exemption, assuming you meet that test, would be $250,000. If you're filing as married, that doubles to $500,000. So what that means in simple terms is, let's say you bought a property for $1 million, 2 years later after living in it, you sell it for $2 million. If you're filing as single, your spread is $1 million, you get $250,000 exempt, which means your long-term capital gains is $750,000. Whereas if you're married, it's $500,000 because you get half off potentially.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
so it's at least something. I know Australia's rules are much better, but yeah.
Well, I mean, okay. Straight up, Australia's rules around main residence are better. However, as we've just discovered, we get a lot more incentives in home ownership in the US because of the standardized deduction. I mean, the itemized deduction that you get and being able to claim things like interest expense and, you know, land tax and those sort of things, state taxes. So, yeah, I mean, it still comes out of the wash. The $500,000 capital gain exemption, that's huge. That is huge. So yeah, if you've held the property for probably 10, 15, 25 years, you might not still even go over that exemption if you're filing jointly. I wonder... And this is a piece where I'm not too educated on from the US side. In the US, I mean, when we buy a property if we're 50-50 joint owners, when we sell the main residence, are we only putting down our 50% component of that capital gain if it's over 250,000? So I've put too much into that. So if we're a homeowner and I only own 10% of that property, am I only still accounting for 10% of the capital gain?
Yeah. So if you own a property with siblings and you guys have your splits percentages, then it would be your capital gain would be based on your percentage of, you know, ownership. So if it was a third, then okay, you take a third of the profit and then you apply your exemption based on if you meet that 2-year out of 5-year rule.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's good. I mean, the 500,000, if you're filing jointly, I mean, it sounds like it's in your best interest from an exemption point of view, but it's always going to come down to individual circumstances. So whatever's going on in that family as well with the income earners. That's been a really good piece. I mean, if we look at it and how it's treated in Australia, yep, on our main residence in Australia, we obviously get the main residence exemption. So it's not a CDT event at all. And what's quite unique about the way that the ATO or tax legend applies to expats, yes, they did remove the main residence exemption for expats. So if you sold your main residence back in Australia and you're overseas, a non-resident of Australia, you do pay capital gains tax on that transaction. So they changed that back in 2019 and then it was fully, I suppose, legislated last year, 30th of June. What's unique though is that if you're an expat and you've been living in your US property for a number of years and you come back to Australia and in Australia you do not have a property, a main residence, even an investment property, you can actually continue to treat your US property in the eyes of the ATO as your former main residence, which means you technically have up to 6 years to sell it, and that would be treated as a capital gains tax, I suppose, exemption event. And that's under the assumption you haven't gone out and bought another main residence in Australia. So you haven't established a main residence in Australia, you've just been renting for those years. So that's a very important piece. And I'm only mentioning that because I do get that inquiry a lot where, oh, what do we do with our US home? Well, you've actually got some time from the Australian side. Obviously, in the US side, it's that 2- and 5-year rule, which Jason just mentioned. And obviously, the capital gain is based on your filing status as well. So that capital gain exemption. But that's how it's treated from an Australian point of view. You can be exempt, assuming you don't have another main residence in Australia when you come back and you only get that sort of time limit. But that's been a good piece. You know, I want to move now down to talking about green card exit tax considerations. So this is always a big one and it's always a good one. And I guess it's just mainly alluding to when that exit tax event comes around. I think it's the HARD Act obviously applies here, but let's go into it. So, I mean, I suppose, Jason, pull it apart for me. What is this exit tax event and how does it come around?
Yeah, so I mean, for something called the HARD Act, it definitely doesn't have heart, I'll say that much, but essentially, if you're a green card holder and you've held a green card for 8 years out of the most recent 15-year window, similar to that 2 out of 5 year rule, it's 8 out of 15, you would be what the IRS considers a covered expatriate. And being a covered expatriate's fine until you want to give up your green card, because the act of giving up your green card triggers this potential exit tax under the HART Act, where Uncle Sam potentially may want their final slice from you as a taxpayer before you can exit the tax system and be free from the IRS from that point forward. Now, just by holding the green card for 8 years and being a covered expatriate doesn't mean you have an exit tax that you have to pay. There are some tests that they would then apply to you once you've met that 8-year threshold that then determine if you have to pay anything at all. Now, the tests, there are two. The first one is, are your net worldwide assets worth $2 million US or more? If so, yes, you have an exit tax. And when why I say net asset is because property often has mortgages attached to it.
Yeah.
So let's say you have a $2 million property, but you have a $1 million mortgage. That means your net asset's $1 million. You're not hit at two for that property.
With that assets test, Jason, I mean, the type of assets that obviously get included in that, I mean, worldwide assets, and does that include things like, say, in the US, a 401k account or an IRA, an Australian super fund account, those sort of types of assets? Is it everything?
It's everything. So it would be your super, your 401k, your properties, your bank accounts. All of these things would be considered in scope for this exit tax because they are assets that you hold. Mm-hmm. You know, cash won't be taxed because it's cash. You're not selling anything by selling cash, whereas 401k is a tax-deferred vehicle. If you were to liquidate it, which would be what's the hypothetical would be on the exit tax, is that you would then, you know, have tax to pay based on the entire lump sum distribution in one go, as opposed to staggering it over the years and things like that. And I'm just realizing it's winter here, so I'm just going to turn on the light quickly. One second.
I was wondering what was going on in the background there, Jason, because it slowly kept getting darker and darker and darker. I was like, I don't know whether he's got some sort of light that's just, it's time to just eventually turn off, because all we're seeing now is a slight beard, some white eyes and some teeth.
Yeah. Look, this is 5 p.m. in California winter. I'm shocked that it's getting dark so quick, but here we are. Yeah, and I saw it happening as well, and I was like, surely this is not what I think it is. And yeah.
That's all good, but assets, so assets test, like you said, it includes everything, but it is net assets. So obviously debt helps reduce the property assets. Cash is cash, so there's not going to be a CGT event around that. And then what's the other test then that gets wound up into this?
Yeah. So let's assume you hold under the 2 million threshold. So you don't meet that test. The secondary test is essentially asking what your average tax liability at the federal level has been over the last 5 years. And this number continues to increase with inflation over time, but currently it's around 170,000. So that average tax liability is at the federal level what tax has been calculated. Not to be confused with this is the amount you owe us with your tax return filing, because that's something different. That's just the amount you have to pay to get to that total liability. So this would be what's been withheld from your wages, all of the other taxes, all of the other credits that show your actual tax calculation before you then back out what's been withheld and showing what's due or what's refundable at the bottom line. So if you do trigger that, even if you have less than 2 million, then you do have an exit tax that you will need to pay on whatever you hold.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so is there, sorry, Jason, you keep going. All right, mate. Yep.
Yeah. So there are strategies and ways that people can plan around this so that they're never caught by it. Some of it might be, you know, if you've been filing jointly with your spouse, your income might be higher than if you're filing alone, so you might want to start filing alone for the for 5 years before giving up your green card, so that way you fail that secondary test. You might want to consider moving assets out of your name into your spouse's name and things like that, so you're under the 2 million threshold. There are strategies you can do. But the overarching one that I would say is that make your decision before that 8-year mark so that this isn't even a thing that you need to worry about. You should not be caught by surprise by the exit tax. You should plan for this well in advance.
Yeah. No, that's honestly what we drill home where, okay, well, we know that you've just gone on a green card. That means, you know, your stopwatch has started. You know, you've essentially got this time now to not worry about it, but around year, whatever it might be, 4 or 5, that's when you've got to consider, you know, are we here for the long run? If we're not here for the long run, we need to start making moves so we're not going to fall foul of this exit tax event and become a covered expatriate. Am I somehow going to look at getting onto an E3 visa, getting off the green card, or L1, or coming back to Australia earlier than predicted? I guess in these situations where we might fall foul of the exit tax event because our assets have grown, our tax liability is high, sometimes people will just go the opposite way and go, you know what, I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty good with life in the US. I think I might stay for another 10 or 15 years. Let's become a US citizen. I've now got access and we'll always be able to draw down on that Social Security as well. We won't lose that 10-year benefit, the 40 quarters. So it just depends. But yeah, sticking your head in the sand and assuming you won't fall foul of it, just apply some simple tests. There is, I think, a bit of a capital gain exemption when you do trigger it, but I don't know the figure off the top of my head. And I think there is a capital gain exemption that does apply on your worldwide assets. But Jace, I don't know if you know that off the top of your head, but it just depends, I think.
Yeah, not off the top of my head. It's been a while since I've had to do the actual calculation for someone, just because everyone's avoided it so far. But
what I've seen, a lot of people, I haven't seen too many people actually fall foul of it. It's pretty rare, but it does happen. But there is an exemption on the capital gain. I can't tell you what it is because I'm sure like any taxation authority, it's probably indexed to a certain degree. I feel like when I first read about the green card and the exit tax and covered expatriate a number of years ago, the average tax liability was actually a lot less. Now it's higher, it's 170, so that's good. A lot of the time these things are indexed. It's much like when you're back in Australia, superannuation, contribution caps, it's indexed, balances are indexed, those sort of things. So yeah, if you think you're going to fall foul of it, definitely do some research, reach out to either myself or Jason and just, go through the simple test just to see whether you are or not. It's a really easy piece just to apply the test, and then it means you can start giving yourself time to plan for the future. Let's move away from that. And just, I suppose, our last topic that I wanted to drill down on, I'm mindful of your time, Jason, is tax implications with receiving an inheritance. And we get this kind of query a lot because, as I said, right now, it's the biggest or largest shift in wealth in Australia moving down to sort of the next gen. A lot of baby boomers are retiring, or the generation before that, obviously, starting to move assets through inheritances. And I guess right now with that big shift, there are a lot of situations coming out where, a good example in Australia, a non-resident beneficiary might receive a parcel of shares from an inheritance. And in Australia, that's normally treated as capital gains tax event K3, which means that that asset is now passing to a tax favorable vehicle, which means tax should be paid in the day of death or date of death tax return compared to wound up in the estate. So we're seeing cases like that. In the US, if I'm a green card holder or a dual citizen, US and Australia, and I'm receiving an inheritance from a non-US person, and let's just say that this inheritance is a parcel of Australian blue chip shares, how's that commonly treated in the US by the IRS?
Yeah, so there wouldn't be an inheritance tax at the federal level if it's, from a non-US person or green card holder. Even if you are a green card holder yourself, there's no inheritance tax. But if you are a green card holder living in the US, depending on which state you're living in, the state might have an inheritance tax. And just an example of a state that I know quite a few Aussies live in, New Jersey is one of the states that do, charge inheritance tax. It's also about planning and potentially making movements if you do think you are going to be receiving an inheritance, just to make sure wherever you are, if you're in the US, that your state doesn't charge it. And then in Australia, as you were saying, there would be those implications.
Yeah, there often are. I mean, Australia as a whole, we don't technically have an inheritance tax. We're always mindful that one year the budget might suddenly release an update and go, oh, hang on, there is a little bit of inheritance tax now, because I suppose you compare us to probably the UK and the Eurozone. A lot of the countries over there, they do have pretty lethal inheritance taxes. So Australia, we're pretty lucky. US, generally not too bad on the federal level. State, well, as you mentioned before the call, a state's like a self-governed country to a degree in the US, so it's just too hard sometimes to know them all off by heart. And I guess that's probably similar to the way in Australia, a lot of different states, they have different land tax rates, stamp duty rates, all those things when you're buying property and exemptions. So every state's different, unfortunately. I guess Australia doesn't have an inheritance tax. However, it's usually when you receive that asset, what you do with it after, that's going to trigger some sort of capital gains tax event. Okay, I receive a parcel of shares. I'm a resident in Australia, that's fine. If I sell those shares, okay, well, that's going to be the CGT event, have to apply the original cost base, those sort of things. When you're a non-resident, a little bit different, just because you are already treated as a tax-favorable vehicle. And I guess really want to drill home here that if you, I mean, does it matter if you're on a visa like an L1 or an E3, or is it still the same sort of situation? You're a US tax resident, so on the federal level, you might be okay. On the state level, it just depends.
Yeah, so it all comes down to your tax residency. If you're a non-resident of America, then it doesn't matter. America can't tax you on things that are out of scope as a non-resident, similar to how Australia can't do the same. But when you are a tax resident, it's your worldwide income, and so it's all fair game.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, visa doesn't really matter if you're a US tax resident at the time. All fair game, worldwide assets. Okay, well, that makes sense. That's pretty uniform, actually. Jason, I might wrap us up there today. It's been a really good episode. Obviously, I love picking your brain on these sort of things. To our listeners, if you've got questions that you have, you know, we do these episodes for you guys. So if you've got questions or want us to drill down on anything, send them to us. You know, we're always happy doing another episode because we do it for you, trying to just educate as many expats as we can in the US. So if you've got any questions or queries, send them in and we can just do another episode and address them. In the meantime, Jason, as always, thanks for your time. I know it's probably getting up to dinner time there with your little one as well. So I'll leave you to be and I'll speak to you soon on the emails, mate.
Thank you, James. Thank you. It was great to chat again. And yeah, look forward to maybe hosting another one with you.
Sounds good, mate. All right. I'll speak soon.